Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Lewis. Those 538 electors on whom Inauguration Day depends are set to meet in their individual states a little less than 2 weeks from now. In every election save three, they've affirmed the will of the people as expressed in the popular vote. But this year, the winner of the popular vote didn't win enough votes in enough states to put her over the top in the Electoral College. And that's why there are a variety of calls for electors not to do what they usually do. Among them is Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig, who says not only should the Electoral College not affirm Mr. Trump, he'll provide free legal counsel to any electors who want to deny him. We'll talk about it after this news from NPR. Glad to have you with us today. On December 19th, a little less than 2 weeks from now, in state capitals all across the country, electors will cast votes for the president, the vice president of the United States. It is the important second part of our two-part process of presidential election. Many of us voted on November 8th, probably not enough, but many of us voted on November 8th. And in all but three such elections, the Electoral College gets together a few weeks later and usually affirms the will of the people as expressed in the popular election. This year, though, there are growing calls for electors not to do what they usually do. And today we'll talk with two Virginia political scientists, Jason Kelly at Virginia Tech and Quentin Kidd at Christopher Newport University. First, though, we'll talk with Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig, who's not only argued that the Electoral College should cast its votes for Secretary Clinton, but he's also offering to support legal fees for any electors who oppose President-elect Trump in violation of state law. And Professor Lessig joins us by phone from New York today. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I wonder if you could walk through for us your read of the Electoral College and its role that leads you to the conclusion that it should first support Secretary Clinton, and then we'll talk about this newer effort here.
Well, sure. So the electors were intended by the framers to be, as Justice Jackson put it, in really the only Supreme Court case to consider the question, the case called Ray versus Blair. They were to be, quote, an independent, nonpartisan judgment, exercise independent and nonpartisan judgment as to the person best qualified for the nation's highest office. And what that court meant in Ray versus Blair was that these electors couldn't be constrained by state law. So state laws that purport to tell them how they have to vote cannot be legally enforced against them, even if, as Ray versus Blair said, they can make a moral pledge. And so that's what the electors have made. They've made a moral pledge to support the ticket that won the majority in their state. Now, that moral pledge, I think, has to be considered against other moral principles of our Constitution. And one of the most important of those, a principle the Supreme Court articulated in 1962, is the principle of one person, one vote. We are all equal citizens. And you can't set up a voting system that unequally weighs us as citizens. And that's what the winner-take-all systems have done. So my argument in the Washington Post was if an elector looked at the fact that Secretary Clinton won this election by more than 2 million votes and considered the fact that it's a tiny, tiny difference that's causing the Electoral College to flip, and the reason it's flipping is because of this violation of this fundamental principle of one person, one vote, that they morally should say, fine, I'm going to vote in a way that allocates my electors according to the proportion of my state, and the consequence of that would be Secretary Clinton would be president.
We're at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. This essay that you've written is getting a lot of comment and a lot of discussion. It's certainly generating that. You've now come up with a new effort called the Electors Trust, which is sort of somewhat related, I suppose, to these Hamilton electors who are members of the Electoral College who have said, look, we are not in favor of Mr. Trump. We sort of think there might be a consensus alternative Republican candidate. These are largely Democrats who are saying, They don't necessarily think the Electoral College would support Secretary Clinton, but they're willing to have a conversation with other electors about the possibility of a consensus Republican candidate, the result of which would be, or the hope on their part is, that Mr. Trump would then fall below the 270 required for election. So tell us what your thinking is on that and what you're proposing.
Well, so what we've created, the Electors Trust, is really working in combination with other groups like the Hamilton Electors and that you've mentioned, and there's also a group called Hamilton Defenders, which are gathering lawyers from around the country to help electors. What we wanted to add was an opportunity for electors to have free legal counsel with a law firm that they could be absolutely confident would keep their identity confidential. So they can contact a law firm, and that law firm will help them understand what legal rights they have and what obligations can lawfully be imposed on them. And it will also give them a chance to learn confidentially, of course, and without identifying anybody's name, whether there are other electors who are in a similar position. Because, you know, it's one thing to step out if you're elector number five, but it's another thing to think about stepping out if you might be elector number 38. And so what we wanted to do was to give them a confidential way to really understand what the lay of the land was. And if they did that, then they might be in a better position to exercise their judgment. We're not pushing one particular vision of what they should do over another. We think this is their choice to be exercised with their moral judgment. We just want to give them the legal support that they might need if they exercise their choice one way or the other.
And acknowledging the confidentiality of this process, do you have a sense of whether people are, or whether electors are accessing this at the moment?
We certainly have a lot of people reaching out to us, and I actually have just gotten off a plane, so I haven't spoken to our lawyers. I'm never going to know anything more than, yes, we have three or five or 10 or 40. But we do know that, you know, the elector who published a piece in the New York Times yesterday, the Texas elector, he announced he was not going to vote for Trump. He became one of the first people, he's public, so there's no confidentiality about this, but he became one of the first people that we've stepped up to try to help.
This is Christopher, I think he pronounces it maybe Suprun or something like that,
that's
S-U-P-R-U-N. He is a firefighter who responded to 9/11, lives in Texas, I believe, and he is has said that he is not going to vote for Mr. Trump, not because of the popular vote differences, but rather he says he is daily showing that he is not qualified for the office. He notes his opinion that Mr. Trump has failed to unite America and is driving a wedge between us. That's a quote from his statement thereon. So we're at 440-266-5-1-800. 940-2240. In the case of Mr. Suprun, he writes, I believe electors should unify behind a Republican alternative, an honorable and qualified man or woman such as Governor John Kasich of Ohio. And we should note that that is a conversation that's underway as well. So we're wondering what you're thinking about all of this at 440-2665-1-800-940-2240. We're talking with Professor Lawrence Lessig from Harvard University, who's written an op-ed in the Washington Post about the Electoral College and about his desire and his urging that the Electoral College support Mrs. Clinton. Bob's on the line from Smithfield. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. Thank you for
taking
my call. This is almost like beating a dead horse, but and when I was 20 years old, I got a top secret clearance, and I knew what it meant. And to this day, you can't ask me about anything without me being super worried about something wrong. I traveled from coast to coast and talked to people. Everybody I was talking to was voting for Trump, only to be voting against Hillary. And for the Electoral College, which definitely needs some sort of overhaul, I don't know what it would be, but in this day of technology, it should be simple enough, you would think. But to go against the conditions that we voted with an understanding that we were in the Electoral College situation, it would just be it's going to cause a lot of problems. I hope everybody realizes that. The problems we've seen from the left has nothing, I don't think, compared to what's possible coming from the right. Anyway, it just seems like it's time to look at an overhaul, but do it before the election, not after the election.
I take your point, Bob. So Bob's concern, Professor Lessig, has to do with the timing of this. If this is a, you'll pardon my term for this, but if this is a legitimate fight to be had, we should have it in time for the next election. What's your take on that?
Well, I agree that the strongest argument against what I'm talking about is the perception that you're changing the rules midstream. The response to that is, well, actually, the rules have always been, and, you know, 9 out of the last 17 elections, we've had electors voting their conscience against what they were told to do. The rules have always been that electors have had this constitutional freedom to exercise their judgment. And that, all I'm talking about is how they should exercise their judgment. Now, you can say, look, it seems unfair to the political campaigns because they ran their campaigns assuming, you know, that Michigan and Pennsylvania and Ohio were going to be the critical states, and now you're saying it's the national popular vote. That's true. But on the other side, there's the fact that there are millions of voters who basically had their votes completely ignored because we have this system created by the states, not the Constitution, that says winner-take-all means all of their votes have to be thrown out. And so all I'm saying is, you know, it's a bad situation on both sides. And so which principle is more fundamental to us? The one that says we shouldn't, put an unfair burden on the campaigns? Or the principle that says we ought to try to elect the person who actually got the most votes? And that's why I think that they ought to step forward and exercise their judgment to pick the person who did get the most votes. And
Professor Lessig, does the size of that difference in the vote totals matter to you? We should note in 2000, forgive me, I can't remember what the difference was between Gore v. Bush, but it was much smaller than more than 2.5 million, I guess, between Secretary Clinton and Mr. Trump.
Yeah, I think the size is incredibly important. Most people look at the 2000 election and say it's essentially a tie. It was about 500,000 votes, and that sounds like a lot of votes, but overall it was essentially a tie. And so in the context of essentially a tie, maybe there's not a strong moral reason for the elector to vote one way or the other. But in this case, there's no tie. This is 2%. This is a hugely significant number. And in a context where we're supposed to be a democracy, you know, what's really striking about our democracy is more people voted for the Democrat for president, but presumptively it's going to be a Republican president. More people voted for Democratic candidates for Senate, but it will be a Republican Senate. And if 2016 follows 2014, more people will have voted Democratic in the House, but it will be a Republican House. We have a democracy where the minority wins and the majority loses. And the only one of those three that's mandated by the Constitution is the Senate. That's the one you'd have to amend the Constitution to fix. But the Electoral College inequality is just produced by the states adopting this rule set called winner-take-all. And in the House, it's because politicians gerrymander their districts that produces this incredible inequality. And I think it's time for Americans to say, hey, we all count equally. Our votes should count equally. And if you counted them equally and added them up, it's clear who the next president should be.
One of your colleagues at Harvard, Noah Feldman, wrote a response to what you have proposed. I'm telling you, it must be the most fascinating thing to be at the faculty lounge at Harvard Law. I think that must be the best thing in the world. But he wrote, "The president-elect broke many of the unwritten norms of electoral politics to win the election. The overarching goal now must be to make sure he doesn't break the Constitution." And his concern is that would your proposal be successful, it would send what he describes as the extremely worrisome message that electoral results are not to be taken seriously as the outcome of a legally constrained process.
Yeah, I have enormous respect for Noah. I think the concern is seriously overblown. What we're talking about is a process that would affirm the person who won the Democratic result. Look, in 2000, even though the result was, difference was small, what we had was a process, the Supreme Court stepping in and stopping a recount that resulted in the person who lost the election popularly becoming the president. So here's an intervention in 2000 that didn't produce a revolution. It didn't produce, people in the streets calling for the end of the American government. What the people said was they recognized that the outcome had been produced in ways that people didn't like, but that was the outcome. In this case, this is what the framers envisioned. They envisioned there would be electors, they would weigh their judgment, they would exercise their discretion, and they would choose based on what the people had done. And I think having them choose to say, support what the people have done, support the person who won the majority vote, is the easiest thing for them to do and the completely easy thing to justify afterwards. Because all we're saying is, look, they bent to make sure the majority winner won.
21 minutes past the hour, and we're talking with Professor Lawrence Lessig from Harvard. Lance on the line from Newport News. Hi, Lance. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Kathy. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your guests as well, and a very interesting discussion. But I think to have reasonable debate, we have to be talking apples and apples and oranges and oranges. The framers envisioned a social republic, not a democracy, and we have a social republic. And originally, the Electoral College was set up so that if the power that be chose someone who was unfit, the electoral was to protect the presidency. At the same time, the founders left in the Constitution that each state sets up its own electoral process. So some electors are mandated now to vote according to the popular vote of their state. Some are not. And this is why I think the midterm elections are the most important election, not the presidency or the every election, because the General Assembly of each state determines the rules for redistricting, for voting, and everything else. And that's why I make it a point to vote in the local elections. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Lance, thank you for the call. And I appreciate your pointing us toward local elections, which are critically important. And I really appreciate the call. We're at 23 minutes past the hour, and it's 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. I want to get Thomas on the line before Professor Lessig has to leave us as well. Hi, Thomas. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a question. It seems like what the guy on the air is talking about is kind of putting the cart before the horse, with the whole Hamilton Electors Initiative. If let's say they do happen to get enough votes that it goes to the House, and by some chance Kasich does get picked by the House of Representatives, what's to stop there being no electoral reform and the Democrats and Republicans just colluding every 4 years to put kind of a centrist candidate through the electors? Like, what guarantee is there that if the Hamilton elector plan was to go through, that there would be electoral change after that? It doesn't seem like there would necessarily be a guarantee there that it would
happen. Got it. All right, Thomas, thank you for the call. Professor Lessig, I want you to weigh in on that, and then we'll, I know you have to leave us, and I appreciate your being here.
Sure. So I think that if the election goes into the House, we can be almost certain that there's going to be electoral reform. Because I think regardless of what the House does, people are going to be so frustrated with the idea that we have this system for electing the president that's supposed to be a system where we all vote, and it doesn't turn out that our vote is really mattering. So I think that actually would be the trigger that forces, whether it's a constitutional change or there's something called the National Popular Vote Project, which is a way to allocate electoral votes that makes sure that they absolutely fit to the popular vote. But either way, I'm sure we would have something in some substantial change. Now, it's really important, though, in the earlier call, he wanted to say that I was wrong because I was talking about this being a democracy and not a republic. But, of course, what our framers meant by a republic was a representative democracy. That's what they said. And by a representative democracy, they meant one where it represented citizens equally. And if we have these systems which don't count votes equally, we're not a representative democracy, and therefore we're not a republic. And so I'm all with him. I want to be a republic. I want to count votes equally. I want to say the winner is the winner. And we don't have that system now, and I think the electors could actually give it. It's within their constitutional right to do that.
Well, it'll be very, very interesting to watch these next nearly 2 weeks. December 19th, of course, the day electors gather across the country to do what we do not know, but all eyes will be on them, no doubt about it. Lawrence Lessig, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today just after announcing this effort called the Electors Trust last night. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for for having me.
Thank you. Professor Lawrence Lessig is the Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard University. You can follow him on Twitter. It's at Lessig, at the little A symbol, L-E-S-S-I-G. We're at 25 minutes past the hour, 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Jason Kelly joining us now from Virginia Tech. He's an expert on American judicial politics, the Congress, public opinion, and political parties. So he's had a lot to do in the last couple of years. Jason Kelly, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So I wonder what your take is on the Electoral College and what it should or should not do on December 19th. You've been studying this. You've read and heard what Professor Lessig is saying. What do you think?
Sure, and it's a fascinating debate to have. I don't think I'm really in a position to answer the normative question, what I think those members should do. I think those 538 members of the Electoral College need to answer that question for themselves. But I will say that if there's ever been an election to test whether the Electoral College is a formality or whether they serve a meaningful constitutional check, this is it.
So this is interesting because Alexander Hamilton, when talking about the Electoral College, essentially said a lot about it, but he said he wanted it as a way to prevent the presidency, to prevent from the presidency those with, quote, talents for low intrigue and little arts of popularity, or those who would, quote, convulse the community with any extraordinary or violent movements. So for you, is this reflection on the Electoral College about the process or the candidates or both?
Well, again, I mean, the Constitution is not very specific as to, you know, when the Electoral College exercises this discretion, what the guidelines are. We get a little bit more of a hint, as you alluded to, Federalist 68 and Alexander Hamilton, but that's that's an article. It's not part of the Constitution. And again, I read the op-ed in the New York Times yesterday, like everybody else, and I was fascinated that the focus was not on policy differences, that it was not on the popular vote, but that it was on the character of the individual taking the office and the importance of the office. And in my mind, that's what the framers had in mind.
You think that I think you're referring to the Republican elector from Texas who's saying, look, I'm a Republican elector, but I'm not pleased with what I am seeing. I'm very concerned, in fact, about what I am seeing. And so that is why I will withhold my vote.
Right. And I think to the extent that they have discretion at all, that's the situation that the framers intended them to exercise it. Now, I'm not a constitutional scholar.
Yeah.
I've taught intro to government and, I've read the Federalist Papers like everybody else. So I'm probably not in the best place to answer this. But personally, that's my interpretation.
Yeah, very interesting. 29 minutes past the hour, 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. The reason I was asking you that, Professor Kelly, the reason we talk with Professor Lessig is there are, you know, this whole concept of the Electoral College has come under scrutiny for a variety of different reasons, one of which is the one we've been talking with Professor Kelly about, which relates to this Texas elector and his decision. The other relates to what Professor Lessig is talking about, which is, you know, one person, one vote. And then the other is expressed by some of our posters on our Facebook page. Kathy writes, I don't want California deciding the election. And that is where Clinton's extra popular vote lies. So a piece of this conversation is also about our geography and about our mobility patterns and our settling patterns in the United States. 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Anita's on the line from Chesapeake. Hi, Anita, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As a naturalized citizen to the United States, I pay great attention to our elections. This is the second time in my voting life here in America that I have voted for a Democratic president. We elected a Democratic president. However, we're going to have a Republican one. My vote does not count, and I'm patiently awaiting the results of the Electoral College vote. If they do not turn this around, I will not vote again because my vote does not count.
Thank you for the call, Anita. Professor Kelly, you're an expert on political parties and public opinion and all the rest of it. What do you say to naturalized citizen Anita, who's saying, look, you know, she keeps voting and doesn't see the result of her and her colleagues' votes in the Electoral College vote?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I have a great deal of both sympathy and empathy for Anita and other people in her situation, which in this election appears to be about, 65 million of us. But if we look back at the 45 presidential elections in U.S. history, five of them, the will of the people was essentially overturned by the Electoral College. That's 11%. So 11% of the time, Electoral College is overturning the popular vote. And there is actually a movement afoot, which I think Anita would be interested to hear about. And it's actually a viable one. Most people will tell you that you need to actually amend the Constitution to get rid of the Electoral College. But as Larry Lessig pointed out, that the problem with the Electoral College is actually at the state level and what they've done. There's actually 10 states and D.C. have already passed laws. It's a compact that they're entering into, which goes into effect if enough states join, such that their total electoral votes would be 270. And then once that compact goes into effect, those states agree to bind all of their electoral votes to the winner of the popular vote, thereby, you know, kind of doing an end around the Electoral College. As far as I can tell, this is perfectly legal. It's constitutional. It doesn't require a constitutional amendment. And you only need, a handful of states to sign off enough to get to 270 electoral votes for this to actually work.
Mm. Interesting point. We're 28 minutes before the hour. We know that there are a number of recounts underway today. These have been requested by the campaign of Jill Stein and the Green Party campaign. Recounts underway in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Jason Kelly, I think even candidate Stein says she doesn't think the election results will be overturned, but she really wants to use this as an opportunity to let people know whether they can be confident in the voting process. I wonder what your take on the recounts is.
Sure. Well, I definitely agree with candidate Stein and Hillary Clinton, for that matter. The odds that the recount overturns the result in even one state are extraordinarily small. The probability that it overturns them in all three states is essentially zero. If we look back at the history of recounts, there's never been a single recount that's gotten even close to the 11,000 votes you need to pick up in Michigan. In addition, at least in two of these states, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, the recount is counting the ballots essentially the same way as they were counted on election night. Now, any recount strategist will tell you that in order to change the outcome in a recount, you need them to count the ballots differently than they counted them on election night, which we are actually seeing in Michigan. So Michigan has 100% paper ballot. They scan their ballots in most instances, but they're doing a hand recount. So Michigan's the state where we're most likely to see change. I believe in Pennsylvania, of the two counties that actually did a recount, the change was 5 votes in favor of Clinton. And in Wisconsin, with 6 counties having counted, the change is net zero, which is pretty much what we would expect to see. Now, I will say that that does seem to give us some amount of faith in the electoral system, to answer the second part of your question.
Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Amanda is on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Amanda. You're on the air.
Hi there, Kathy.
Hi.
Thank you for today's show.
You're welcome.
Two quick points. One, to follow on, I understand Dr. Lessing was promoting one person, one vote, which I'm totally for. I do wish more people would take a look, or people in power and influence, to overturn Citizens United, as I believe that is not one person, one vote. I think it's counter to that. And my second point is, you mentioned a bit ago about the geography and the configuration of the states. And on election night, as you could all see the results coming in, clearly this was an election that was won by rural areas. Mm-hmm. And it's a challenge, I think, if we are going to revisit the electoral process in general. You don't want these less densely populated states to have all of the results driven by the coastal states and the more densely populated states. So my only input to that is just that I don't see a complete revamping of the electoral system that would lose that ability to give credit to less densely populated states.
Amanda, I appreciate the call, and you're pointing up this geographic change we've undergone as a country, where we have so many people in our sort of population centers. Jason Kelly, Amanda's concerned that rural America be represented fairly in this process, but the way the system is set up now, votes from some states are quote-unquote more valuable, have more meaning, I should say, more weight than votes from other states, depending on where you are population-wise. Less populous states carry more weight.
Sure, with the Electoral College, that's absolutely the case. So if you were to go to a system where the winner of the popular vote won the election, you would essentially have one person, one vote. Now, there are two comments. Amanda made the comment, or alluded to it in the Facebook comment you read earlier, which suggested that coastal states or California, the vote matters more. But that's not really the case. I mean, you can take any state and you can say, well, that's the pivotal state. Everybody's vote is equal, whether you're rural, urban, whether you're coastal, whether you're inland, under a popular vote system. So just because we count California last, it doesn't mean that California was pivotal.
Hmm. Amanda, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. But, you know, this is the, if you are from a small rural, I don't say small state, but a less populous rural state, you can understand why people would be concerned about that. So it's an interesting conundrum as we move forward. 22 minutes before the hour, that's Jason Kelly. He's an associate professor of political science at Virginia Tech. Quentin Kidd joins us now. He's the vice provost for undergraduate education and a professor of political science at Christopher Newport University, where he also directs the Wasson Center for Public Policy. Quentin, thanks again for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Good to be with you, Kathy.
So I want to get your take first on these recounts. Do you think that is something that demonstrates a lack of confidence in the voting population, or is it, as some have suggested, that candidate Stein is trying to raise money for some future Green Party efforts?
Well, let me just say first, I would echo Jason's thoughts about the probability of overturning a state or even overturning the entire election. I just think the probability is very low. Perhaps most high in Michigan, in part because it sounds like in Detroit there were as many as 75,000 ballots that didn't have a presidential vote recorded, which may suggest some systemic problem that could cause a lot of votes to come in that weren't there on election day. So that may matter in Michigan, but the reality is the odds of overturning any given state are low, and the odds of overturning the election in general are really, really low. So I think it reflects, in part, how complicated vote counting actually is, and most people don't realize it because, let's take Virginia, for example. Virginia went Clinton by 5 points, and so we don't pay attention to the fact that vote counters in Virginia have spent a lot of time counting absentee ballots and counting votes that were cast provisionally. And the reason we haven't paid a lot of attention to that is because all of those votes totaled aren't going to be enough to change the outcome. And so we just move on. Virginia went Clinton by 5 points. We move on. But in a state where the vote is really close, those provisional ballots and those absentee ballots really do matter. And so you can call a state. North Carolina is a good example of this. You could call a state, and the winner of the governor's race in North Carolina, as it turns out, won by only several thousand votes. And so those provisional ballots and those absentee ballots really matter. The reality is when you cast your vote on Election Day, most of us have our votes counted on Election Day, but a number of us don't have our votes counted for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 days after Election Day. And in a close election, those 2 or 3 or 4 or 5% of votes that are counted after Election Day might really matter.
We're at 20 minutes before the hour. It's 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Wondering today whether you believe the Electoral College should affirm Mr. Trump or not, and why. 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Quentin Kidd, I want to put that question to you. There are all kinds of issues around the Electoral College. What do you think it should do when those electors convene in their state capitals on December 19th?
Well, the Electoral College is a process. People often think of it as an institution because we think of colleges as institutions and universities. We kind of link those, but it's a process. And so the process should be followed. But I agree with the other two guests. It's a process that empowers a group of people to evaluate the merits of candidates. And to vote for or against, really you're going to vote for, but you could be voting against by voting for. You're going to vote for a candidate for president that you feel is legitimately qualified and has the right qualities to be president. And so the reality is if the Electoral College voted for Hillary Clinton or John Kasich to be president, for example, that's perfectly within their constitutional rights and duties to do so, even though some states have bound their electors. In other words, made their electors sign a pledge saying they would vote for whoever the state voted for president. There's no court case, as far as I can tell, that tests that, whether a state can punish somebody, an elector, for not voting the will of the state. And the Constitution empowers electors to choose the president. That's the system that we have, like it or not, until we change it, if we do change it. And so I think the electors are obligated to do what the Constitution says they should do, which is consider the qualities of the candidates before them and vote either for one of those candidates or for another candidate that they think is more qualified. The vast majority of them are going to vote the way they pledge to vote.
Right.
There are going to be some that don't, though. I think this is an election where we're going to see more than we have in recent history not vote the way they're pledged to vote.
And it's very interesting. So the numbers we're looking at on this are what? I think it's 38 or something, that 38 electors would have to switch their votes. Maybe I should say not vote for Mr. Trump in order to have that happen. Is that correct?
Yeah.
That's a long shot, right?
It's a very long shot. Although we've had more momentum towards that this year than we have in 2000, than we did in 2000. And 2000 was the first year that we had a lot of momentum toward trying to convince electors to change their votes or to vote a certain way in the Electoral College. My assumption is that Donald Trump is going to win the Electoral College vote. This may get us further down into a detailed conversation that we're not ready to go to right now, but it could also be the case that the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate refuses to accept the Electoral College votes that come to them if the electors don't choose Donald Trump to be president. I mean, this could become an even more confused constitutional crisis if the electors certain electoral votes are challenged in the House and the Senate when they're presented. And so it could become much more confusing. I don't think in the end it's going to become confusing like that.
But as the rules are, if I understand this correctly, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, the House would make that decision, right, in the case that there were not 270 electoral votes.
Yeah, the House and the Senate meet in joint session, and they essentially tabulate the votes. And any given vote can be challenged by any member of the House or the Senate. And so I'd imagine that if you had an unfaithful elector, I would not be surprised, for example, if the Texas elector, who's already said, he's not going to vote for Donald Trump. I would not be surprised if that elector's vote is not challenged by a member of the Texas delegation. And so, you know, that may become an interesting academic question. I don't think it's going to change the outcome of the of who wins or the presidency.
Fascinating. You can, by the way, we've had not a lot of phone lines available throughout the show because so many folks are calling in. We do have one available for you now at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Jesus is on the line from Yorktown. Hi, Jesus. You're on the air.
How are you?
Fine,
you can imagine with a name like Jesus, you can guess that I wasn't born in the United States. However, I am a naturalized citizen. I've had a very successful career. But anyway, the argument that I'm hearing you guys discuss is a little bit laughable because it brings to me the point that we have in this great nation of ours so many rights and not a single duty. And that specifically applies here where we have the right to vote, but not the duty to vote.
Mm.
And I don't think we can really discuss thoroughly the implications of the popular vote and the electoral college until we actually have mandatory voting from every citizen that is qualified to vote. And for those citizens that choose not to vote, I would suggest that they pay some kind of penalty that they can be used to fund K through 12 education at the local level.
Jesus, may I ask where you're from originally?
I was born in Peru.
Peru, okay. And I think Peru is one of 22 countries where voting is mandatory. So you're well familiar with this process.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right.
Jesus, I want to thank you for your call from Yorktown today. You know, this is an interesting point, Professor Kelly, that Jesus brings up about, and it brings us to this conversation, which is not directly related to the Electoral College, but is certainly a feature increasingly of our public life together. And that is, while we are talking about the results of the election, we should clarify that we are talking about the results of an election in which less than half the people, or right about half the people, voted in the first place. So, what do you make of Jesus's point and the relationship to the obligation to vote?
Well, right. So, I mean, in the U.S., unlike Australia or Peru or other countries that have mandatory voting, there's no penalty for not voting. Many countries you can exercise your disgust with the system by invalidating your ballot or writing in some sort of funny name. I don't really have a strong opinion one way or another on mandatory voting. I don't know really that it changes much. I think maybe your broader point was that we have elections that take place in this country where, only 60% of registered voters vote, voting age voters even lower than that. What kind of mandate do they have? So I guess to the extent that you're trying to get at a mandate or a comfort with this is the choice of the American people, then sure, mandatory voting makes sense. But I don't feel strongly one way or the other.
And I'm not sure we'll ever get there. Professor Kelly, I want to thank you for joining us today from Virginia Tech.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. 12 minutes before the hour, again, 22 countries where the voting process is mandatory, is required.
Kathy, can I add, I'm not sure that it would be constitutional to require voting. I understand
that's what I was
sentiment.
Wondering about, yeah.
And we talk about, I talk about that with my students about the idea of duty versus responsibility. I think Jesus raised an excellent point. I don't think we can legally enforce it, in part because there are people who vote to express an opinion, obviously. There are people who don't vote to express an opinion, a political opinion, and we have freedom of speech in this country. It's a constitutionally guaranteed freedom. I could not imagine a situation where somebody was penalized for not voting and then them saying, I didn't vote to make a point, and the court not say, you're right.
You have the right.
You have the constitutional right to make a point like that.
11 minutes before the hour, Professor Quentin Kidd joining us from Christopher Newport University. Quentin, it strikes me this elector that we've been talking about in the course of this hour from Texas has mm-hmm. real qualms. You know, he's a Republican elector. He has real qualms about Mr. Trump around. He notes he failure to unite, not qualified temperamentally, foreign lack of foreign policy experience, and the rest of it. He says he believes that electors should unify behind a Republican alternative, such as Governor John Kasich of Ohio. Now, no word yet on whether Governor Kasich would accept such a thing, but is this unique in our history where you have the possibility, because I know we have had faithless electors before, but not a lot of them. Is this unique where you have a situation where you have eight Democratic electors who are saying, okay, we get it. You guys are probably not going to go with the person who won the popular vote, but we really want somebody other than Mr. Trump. So could we negotiate on this and get a consensus Republican? I mean, is that unique in our history?
Let me just say this. In the mid-1800s, we went through a period of elections where we had dozens and dozens of faithless electors. In 1832, something like 23, in 1836, 23 Democratic electors from Virginia refused to support the Democratic candidate because there was rumors that that Democratic candidate had slept with an African-American woman. And so, you know, we have a history in the mid-1800s of a lot of faithless electors. Now, the number of faithless electors dwindled down to single digits into the last century and obviously up till today. So it is not unprecedented. And in the mid-1800s, we had relative political upheaval in this country as it related to the establishment of the two-party system. And so we have relative political instability right now as it relates to the political party system. And so I don't think it's a surprise to me anyway when I think about the history of our political process that we have more discussion of unfaithful electors this year than in recent history because we have had a pretty tumultuous political party process in the last several election cycles.
I'm going to second that emotion for you. Frank is on the line from Norfolk. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. I'd just like to toss out there the possibility of overcoming this winner-take-all model by every state adopting the same model that Maine and Nebraska have of awarding the electoral votes by congressional district. If every congressional district had one vote and then you just added them up for the whole country and gave, you know, awarded the presidency to whoever had the majority votes, that seems to me to be a fairer system than each state, except for Maine and Nebraska, getting a winner-take-all status.
Frank, thank you for the call. Quentin, what do you think about what Frank's talking about?
Critics would say good intentions, but in an age of partisan redistricting like we have right now, all that would happen is the manipulation of the election would simply move to the redistricting process that happens every 10 years in every state. And so people would resist that unless you also got rid of political figures drawing their own districts, you know, elected officials in every state legislature drawing the districts. That would be the problem with that. I mean, the problem here is there's no simple, easy solution to this. We're at a point in the history of our country where people don't get why the popular vote doesn't elect the president, not paying attention or not caring as much about the founding of the nation and the idea that the presidency was supposed to reflect not only the will of the people but the will of the states as well. And the Electoral College brings a voice for the states to the table. And that's important because states, remember, we're a federation of sovereign nations. Virginia is a sovereign nation that has given up a portion of its sovereignty to the national government, along with all the other states. And you know, I realize that I'm speaking there at a theoretical or conceptual level.
It's very interesting.
That's really where it comes from. And so we would change the nature of our political system if we changed that.
And we actually had a caller recently who, on that point, said, and I thought this was a very interesting point. She said, she feels that we as a nation should be doing one person, one vote, abolishing the Electoral College, because her sense is that, yes, we started out orienting ourselves more towards states, and that is absolutely correct. Yet she says now, with communication and with shifting transportation patterns and the like, she really feels that we are more federal citizens than state citizens. And so her take is every vote should count equally.
I think, and I think that's fair, and I think a lot of people would agree with that. It would require constitutional changes, and so essentially we would have to have something equivalent to a national plebiscite in order to do that. But I think a lot of people feel that way. Until the Civil War, most people, when you asked them where they were from, would refer to their state. They were
right.
Virginians. They were
yes.
from Virginia. It was only after the Civil War that there was a concerted effort to make us think about ourselves as a nation. And so people started referring to themselves as Americans, primarily before their states. But in many states, you still get people who would say, I'm a Texan. I'm thinking of Texas because it's very common there. I'm a Texan before I'm an American. Now, they don't mean that in an unpatriotic way. They just mean that they're proud
that
of
they're
Texas.
Very, yeah, yeah.
Right.
So one of our Facebook posters, Mark, said one way to mitigate the split without getting rid of the Electoral College would be to assign an additional 100 representatives to Congress and then recalculate the proportionality that the states get and the number required to be elected. And there's been conversation about that, hasn't there, mm-hmm. About adjusting that number and adding more representatives to places that are more populous.
That's true. Originally, a member of the House of Representatives represented about 60,000 people. Today, they represent around 700, a little over 700,000 people.
Wow.
So one could argue that we're way behind when it comes to keeping up with the level of representation that we had at the origins of the country, but that would require a House of Representatives that was probably 10 times bigger than it is right now in order to match that. So it would be a difficult task to achieve. They would have to have an extension or an addition onto the House of Representatives chamber.
Yeah, right.
Just to seat everybody. But, the British House of Commons does not have enough seats to seat every member of the House of Commons if they all show up at the same time.
Wow.
And so, it doesn't matter. They can stand off in the corners. You could have a system where junior members were at the back standing and senior members were sitting in seats. I mean, I'm being facetious, but it's possible to be done.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. Listen, I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Quentin Kidd. This is a conversation that we will no doubt continue. I think it's going to be – so what your take is that on December 19th, you think Mr. Trump gets affirmed?
I think he gets affirmed. I'm not going to be surprised if we have a number and maybe even a dozen unfaithful electors, but they're not all going to go one way. It's not going to be a dozen who don't vote for Trump and vote for Hillary. It's going to be a number of Democratic electors that are unfaithful that vote for somebody else, and it'll be some Republican electors that are unfaithful and vote for somebody like John Kasich.
Got it. All right, Quentin Kidd, what a show. I thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it, Quentin.
Thanks, Kidd.
You're welcome, and thank you for all of your thoughts and your calls today. This is a part of our continuing conversation called After the Vote. We're going to be doing this on a weekly basis because this is such a unique election cycle and so much is at play here. So thanks for joining us for today's conversation. Great get for our staff today, putting this show together as events were changing late. We appreciate it so much. And by we, I mean me. Up next here on 89.5, it's the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Then coming up tonight on WHRO TV 15 at 8 and 9, it's a look back at Pearl Harbor. You won't want to miss that. Thanks for listening. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.